the Moan Broadcast Center. This is Take Two. Me, Martinez. The race for the White House still too close to call. And for those who are hoping for a convincing win, the closeness of the contest is a troubling sign for America. Plus, you love LA sports teams, but do you love where their political donations go? Find out how the owners of the Dodgers and Lakers line up with your ballot. It's all ahead on Take Two. Stay with us. From 89.3 KPCC and KPCC.org, this is Take Two. I'm A. Martinez. Thanks for joining us today. All right, as of right now, we're still in a holding pattern on the presidential race. The Associated Press reports that Joe Biden's electoral college count stands at 264, really just one state away from securing the 270 needed to win the White House. But other outlets have him still at 253. It all comes down to how you count Arizona right now. We'll be watching the count, and we definitely will alert you if anything changes. But whichever way the electoral college shakes out, there are two storylines we want to address that have gotten a lot of attention. One is that while Biden leads in the popular vote, Trump has gotten nearly 6 million more votes this time around than in 2016. So what does that tell us about how Americans feel about Donald Trump? And two, since much of that increased voter support came from Latinos, what did the president's campaign say or do that mobilized this diverse group of people? Mike Madrid is a longtime GOP strategist with an expertise in Latino voting trends and co-founder of the Lincoln Project. Mike, considering that the aim of the Lincoln Project is to prevent the re-election of Donald Trump, what do you make of the president's support at the ballot box generally?
Well, ultimately, the best data point, A, is to make sure that you win, right? That was the objective, and it looks very clear that we're going to be defeating Donald Trump at the polls. But as you appropriately, explained in the intro here, there's a lot underneath that is driving some of Trump's support, some of which I think came from some very surprising corners, not the least of which is an increased level of support amongst Latinos, Hispanics, specifically men, oftentimes U.S.-born males under 40, that have a specific kind of appeal, or Trump has a specific appeal to this demographic that honestly is not unlike what the appeal is to white, non-college-educated males. And this is really, I think, indicative of a broader assimilative pattern where Hispanics are going to be trending towards Republicans or Republicanism. And I think that that will be a growing trend over the next couple of decades.
And we're going to get more into Latino support for Trump in just a second, Mike. Generally, though, when 6 million more votes almost, that's a lot from one election cycle to another. When it comes to just that big, giant uptick in Trump's popular vote, what do you think accounts for that?
Well, I think that, look, this was the historically, this is the highest turnout election in the history of the American Republic. But you've got to put it in context. He also is going to lose by the widest margin in history in the popular vote. And Joe Biden got, 4, 5, 6 million more votes than he did. So, yeah, Donald Trump got more votes, but he also lost by what will probably be the largest popular vote margin in a very long time.
Is it a reaction, you think, to maybe just people, the anger and vitriol that comes with a reaction to Donald Trump? Do you think that inspired people to say, no, you know what, I stand by this guy and I'm going to vote for him. I'm going to show people why I stand by him.
I don't think there's any question that happened, especially with his base, but it also had the reverse effect with those that truly dislike him. He drove turnout amongst his own base, but he also was a bigger driver of even more turnout with people who do not like him. I think that's the story of what happened Tuesday night is, yeah, he's a lightning rod. He chose to be, and the politics that got him elected ultimately are the politics that served as his undoing.
Yeah, because a lot of people, Mike, expected or at least hoped for a much wider margin between the candidates. For instance, columnist Jamelle Bouie's opinion piece in the New York Times today is titled, "We Waited in Vain for a Repudiation That Never Came." So, Mike, what is it that people still are not getting when it comes to the appeal of the president?
Well, I think a lot of this has to do with identity politics, and identity politics has a lot more salience with each individual person than broader thematics like the safety, security of our country or the sacredness of our Constitution and our governing principles. And I think that that's something that we're going to have to understand is part and parcel of American politics and probably will be for a generation as Americans undergo a very significant demographic change. So, look, I think the other way to ask the question is, why in the world are so many people voting for a president who knowingly obstructed constitutional norms, and he regularly uses vulgarity and offensive terms and defiled the sacredness of the office of the presidency. The question, I think the answer remains the same, depending, again, on how you phrase the question, and that is our own identities, I think, have become much more important to us than the broader respect of this republic abroad and even amongst ourselves.
Why do you think, though, Mike, it matters that any repudiation has to happen? I mean, isn't a win, if that happens, enough for Democrats?
If you believe that a win for the sake of the win matters, then I suppose that would be true. I think that people are hoping for a broader statement about American character. When you have a president who, again, regularly violates the Hatch Act, desecrates the Oval Office for political purposes, somebody who has knowingly acknowledged, this affinity for nationalism and supremacy, white supremacy, I think that that's something that is not part and parcel of the American character. Or let me rephrase that. It is a part and parcel of the American character, but it's one that we had hoped was behind us, not once celebrated from the highest office in the land.
But if that character then is something that at least one group of people hopes can change, then is the starting point when that group says, look, what are you doing? What were you thinking? Is that a great starting point for that kind of reconciliation?
I think that what Donald Trump demonstrated is that reconciliation is not part and parcel of Trumpism. Mm. He governed literally from the very first day in dividing Americans and trying to create a president for red America against and blaming blue America. While we need to bring people together, as Joe Biden has suggested, we cannot forget this moment, this dark hour in American history. This is not any type of characteristic of any president in the history of our republic. It's exactly the opposite of the call that Abraham Lincoln made in asking for a united country. A house divided cannot stand. This president cemented his identity on tearing and dividing America apart. And I think that having a great vision of that type of a stance would have served us better going forward. But I remain confident in the Americans' ability to do the same.
Does that turnout, though, that extra 6 million almost people that turned out for him, does that mean that Trumpism is here to stay, even if he ends up not staying in power?
I believe it is, and that's why the Lincoln Project has set forth as a goal to marginalize and remove Trumpism. It is a divisive, failed ideology. It's about a people who I believe are more concerned about their own loss than people rising up together as one nation. And I think it defies the myth and the character of who we are as a people. So yes, unfortunately, I believe Trumpism will be with us for some time. It's why the Lincoln Project will be here as long as it exists.
Joe Biden has repeatedly said that even though he's running as a Democrat, he wants to be a president for all Americans. Mike, there are almost 6 million or 69 million voters who voted for Trump who might not agree with that. So how would you advise a Democratic president to begin to extend an olive branch to Trump supporters? Or is it even possible? Hello, Mike, you still there?
President. Have pursued up until Donald Trump. And I think that the best way to seek unity is to bring people together rather than to bring them together as opposed to divide them.
Senator Mike Madrid, GOP strategist, co-founder of the Lincoln Project. Now, Mike, part of your expertise is in Latino voting trends. And so far, it appears that this year Trump was able to secure the votes of more Latinos in battleground states than in 2016. Did any of that surprise you?
Yeah, I let me correct you, though. It actually only surpassed in one battleground state, which is Florida, unless, of course, you consider Texas a battleground state, which I suppose it is. Latinos will actually be probably a decisive metric in putting Joe Biden over the top in Arizona. And what we're learning about the Latino vote is that not only is it getting bigger, in fact, it's now the second largest ethnic voting group right behind whites, surpassing blacks for the first time in history this November, but it's becoming far more diverse. And my guess is in the not too distant future, we'll be dealing with Latinos with specific subgroups with specific messaging to each of those voters based off of nationality, college education and income and geography, as opposed to just using a broad umbrella, calling them Latinos or Hispanics.
Yeah, because there was a lot of people, Mike, that were shocked by that occurrence, that happened. But where do you think that shock is rooted in? Because I got to be honest with you, it's always felt a little insulting to me to assume that Latinos are this big brown voting bloc that's just rushing to vote centers to cast their ballot for a Democrat.
Yeah, in fact, I agree with you, A. We've talked about this over the years. Between the two of us, this was actually the basis of my work at Georgetown University 30 years ago. That's why I actually became a Republican. I think the answer to the question might be why I repudiate Trumpism, is there's no problem with celebrating and recognizing the differences and the diversity within the Latino community, as you and I have discussed. Where it becomes problematic is where you have somebody, a president like Donald Trump, who believes that white identity is really what defines Americanness, and some of the offensive racist language used by the president beginning with his campaign in 2016 and continuing through his presidency, I think really exacerbated and shocked a lot of people that Latinos wouldn't be offended by that to a greater degree.
Do you think the turnout, or maybe the shock to the turnout, was about Latinos voting Republican or Latinos voting for Trump, or maybe something else?
That's a really great question. I think it's probably more for Trump, but I think a lot of people really associate Trump and Republicanism as one and the same. Again, my work over 3 decades ago that began was on whether or not Latinos would gradually vote more and more Republican. Probably a little bit ahead of the curve and kind of asking that question. And ironically, it may be 2020 where we start to see that break happen. Listen, I do believe that we are going to see more Latinos voting Republican. I think it has a lot more to do with the deficiencies, frankly, of the Democratic Party in addressing some issues. But I think that if Republicans can be more aspirational for Latino voters, especially with middle-class economic concerns, they have a possibility of coming back and recovering. If they don't, if they choose to continue down the path of nationalism and Trumpism, my strong suspicion is they will continue down the ways of California's politics, where the Republican Party becomes a small, regional, very racially monolithic group.
What did Joe Biden not do in terms of mobilizing more Latinos to vote for him?
I think the overemphasis of Joe Biden and, frankly, the Democratic Party generally on stereotypical ethnic issues, thinking that Latinos only care about border wall issues, for example, the kids in cages issues. These are very important issues, but they're important issues to everybody broadly as human beings. What they did was they just felt that that was all that they needed in order to secure the votes. Latinos for decades have been telling us that the economy and jobs are the number one concern for the Hispanic community, followed closely by education and health care. But you heard very, very little of that on the campaign trail, almost non-existent. And the Democratic Party really has to do some self-introspection and recognize that there needs to be a better, broader place for working-class people who work with their hands, who work in manufacturing jobs that oftentimes Democrats are seeking to eliminate. And that odds, that fight, that adversarial relationship is not only leaving Latinos with no alternative, but it's adversarially pushing them into the Republican column, despite the fact that Republicans sometimes have candidates like Donald Trump who may offend them culturally or personally.
You know, many people have pointed out that what Cuban Americans may care about in Florida is not the same as what Mexican Americans in Arizona may care about, for instance. So how much is a national strategy for reaching Latinos impossible? And because, you know, considering it's all about location, 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 like the old real estate phrase.
Well, that's actually, I think, the exact right question at the exact right time. And I think that, unfortunately, a lot of strategists and leadership in both parties have, up until November of 2020, addressed this as one big, you know, umbrella group and not acknowledging the diversity that exists. The truth is now, because of the disbursement of the community, especially in the Southwest and in Florida and in places like Texas, increasingly Pennsylvania, North Carolina, it's indisputable that these differences exist. So I'm hoping that this will be the last election cycle where both parties address it as one broad umbrella and start to recognize the need to be much more sophisticated and nuanced in speaking to the geographical differences, the educational differences, the immigrant difference in the immigrant experiences, generational differences, and obviously the national origin and language barriers. You and I, again, have spoken about this at great length. These differences need to be acknowledged because the size of the vote is now so big that just using the stereotypical sombrero-type politics doesn't work anymore. The truth is, it hasn't worked for some time. It's just now glaringly obvious because is having a direct impact on the election of the president.
Well, that takes resources, right, Mike? I mean, it takes you hire someone that knows, or actually more than one person that knows and wants to spend some time really cutting this up. But political candidates and campaigns don't tend to want to do that, seemingly.
They're going to have to do it if they want to win, and I think that's the message for this election cycle. So, yes, you're right. Up until this point, you're exactly right. They have not wanted to invest in it. Candidly, they have treated Latino voters just as kind of quote-unquote minority voters, lumping them into the African-American segment of the electorate. But with Latinos growing at a 2% clip per year, the party leadership in the Democratic Party, along with the Republican Party, is overwhelmingly white. They don't have an acknowledgement and they don't have an appreciation for the nuance of this segment of the electorate. And until they do, they're going to continue to see the results that came out on election night.
That's Mike Madrid, longtime GOP strategist with an expertise in Latino voting trends and also co-founder of the Lincoln Project. Mike, thanks a lot.
Great talking to you, A. Thank you.
There was so much on California voters' plate that we could not get to it all yesterday, but we knew there was a tomorrow, which is today. Now, actually. Well, soon. Coming up, the fates of Propositions 19, 21, and Measure J. That's up next when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and streaming on kpcc.org. Amy Martinez. All right, now let's take a look at a few more of those propositions on Californians' ballots. And today we're focusing on housing, specifically Props 19 and 21. Now, Prop 19 would let residents 55 and older save on property taxes when they purchase a new home. And Prop 21 attempted to expand rent control measures statewide. With us to break both of these down is Matt Levin, housing and data reporter for Cal Matters and co-host of the podcast Gimme Shelter. Matt, let's start with Prop 19, still too close to call. Remind us of what exactly this proposition would do.
So bear with me because this is a little complicated, which I think is part of the reason why it's still too close to call. But there's two main parts to Prop 19. The first one is the one you reference. That's a tax break for Californians over the age of 55 or victims of natural disasters when they buy a new home. So that home could be more expensive or less expensive than the home they're currently living in. It could be bigger or smaller. And proponents argue that there's thousands of California seniors stuck in their home because they don't want to pay higher property taxes or can't afford higher property taxes when they buy a new one. The second component to this is how Prop 19 would actually pay for that property tax break. And they do that by taking away a different property tax break. This is an inheritance tax loophole that Prop 19 tries to close. Right now, California adult children, when they inherit a home from their parents, they can rent out that home or use it as an Airbnb and still pay their parents low property taxes. They're not only inheriting the property, but they're inheriting the property tax rate as well. That would be closed under Prop 19. A child would actually have to live in the house in order to retain the lower property tax rate.
Now, it's too close to call, but yeses are leading, right? It's a slight lead. What do you make of where this is going and how it's played out so far?
So it is too close to call, and I wish there was a way that I could, you know, get my Steve Kornacki on and predict based off the demographics of what votes are yet to be reported, how this thing is going to end up. But, you know, there's at least an estimated 2 million ballots that have yet to be counted, primarily coming out of Southern California. And because there was a decent amount of confusion on this measure, who would support it, who would oppose it, I can't really give you a bellwether one way or the other, how it's going.
So, okay, so let's get into maybe why it's so close then. What's behind voter support and what has the opposition been saying?
So I think progressives were somewhat conflicted on this measure. They liked closing that inheritance tax loophole I referenced earlier. There was an LA Times investigation that found that the beneficiaries of that loophole were often significantly wealthy families who probably could afford higher property taxes. But progressives somewhat chafe at providing yet another property tax break to California homeowners over 55 who tend to skew wealthier. Mm-hmm. On the flip side, conservatives, kind of spearheaded by the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association, which is the primary opposition to this measure, they don't like the inheritance tax loophole being closed. They're okay with providing an additional property tax break for older homeowners, but they want to keep that inheritance tax loophole alive. So there's real conflict on both left and right over how to vote for this measure.
So what's that old saying? I mean, a good compromise is when both parties are dissatisfied. Something like, I mean, it sounds like this is right exactly what that quote is all about.
Sure. And I think I should say, the California Democratic Party has endorsed this measure. Governor Gavin Newsom has endorsed this measure. And that's primarily because when you look at the analysis of how this is actually going to impact local governments, it looks like there's going to be a net increase in money coming to school districts and cities and counties and even the state. And then some of that money would end up in the special firefighters fund that proponents included in this measure. So that portion of kind of the left is behind this measure.
And I would imagine a housing stock would open up a little bit for a certain kind of family. So there's a little bit of a win there too.
Yeah, and that's certainly what the California Association of Realtors is arguing. They're the big political and financial force behind this measure. They've poured over $40 million into it. And their argument is, look, if we can induce some of these California seniors to downsize, that means more starter homes might open up for home ownership opportunities for California renters who have been waiting to buy homes for years now.
Talking to Matt Levin, housing and data reporter for Cal Matters. All right, let's go to 21. That would have allowed cities to expand rent control to more properties. That was defeated. What do you make of the proposition's failure and actually the margin of the loss?
So this is a pretty big setback yet again for tenants' rights groups and the rent control movement broadly. So in two consecutive elections, an effort to allow cities to expand rent control has been defeated by a significant margin. So it looks, again, to caveat, there are still ballots to be counted, but it looks like Prop 21 is headed towards about a 20-point defeat.
Oh, wow.
Prop 10 from 2 years ago lost by about 20 points. So there was hope among tenants' rights groups and certainly the backers of this measure that in a general election in 2020, you'd get bluer turnout, you'd get more renters to the polls, or I guess now casting mail ballots. And that did not appear to materialize in the way they hoped.
One last thing, Matt, I mean, so isn't the first time rent control has failed in California. What's the significance of this loss when we think of the future of affordable housing here in California?
So I think it's significant that not only did the statewide initiative lose, but some local rent control initiatives also lost. In Burbank, a local rent control initiative lost. In Sacramento, a pretty large city, a local rent control initiative lost. So I don't know if you're going to see a lot of momentum, especially at the state level, behind rent control going forward. I would be surprised if this kind of rose to the top of legislators' agenda here in the Capitol. They're going to be very focused on eviction protections and the expiring eviction moratorium that's scheduled to happen in January.
You know, we've talked about some of the progressive victories in LA yesterday. When we see the failure, though, of Prop 21 and a possible victory for realtors on 19, I mean, what do these results tell us about California voters' priorities when it comes to housing?
It's an interesting question. So I think what is definitely fair to say is that if you could somehow transport back in time to January or February before the pandemic hit, housing was the issue in California. Housing and homelessness. The governor devoted his entire state of the state to those twin issues. And the pandemic, I think, has gobbled up a lot of the political oxygen that was and media attention that was devoted to housing and homelessness. I think that's part of the explanation here. I don't think it's the full explanation.
All right. That's Matt Levin, housing and data reporter for Cal Matters, co-host of the podcast Gimme Shelter. Matt, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much, eh?
Well, Los Angeles County voters appear to have passed Measure J. Now, think of the J to mean justice, because its supporters say it brings justice to the disadvantaged communities around the county. The Board of Supervisors put the measure on the ballot with the promise that when passed, it would ensure 10% of the budget always goes to social programs and services in those same neighborhoods.
It would involve more funding for community programs, for education, for employment, for reentry programs for people who are coming home from jail or prison.
That's Loyola Law Professor Priscilla Ochen on our show yesterday as Measure J was headed toward a win. The idea is that if the county is obligated to invest more in social programs, then it will prevent larger social issues down the line that are tougher to handle.
Instead of responding to social problems like homelessness, mental illness, drug addiction with policing and punishment, many advocates across the county have said, why don't we address this in terms of the problems themselves?
The LA County Sheriff's Department was a very vocal opponent of Measure J, with Sheriff Alex Villanueva believing it was a veiled attempt to cut his department's budget. But the language of the initiative does not say that funding social programs would come at the expense of law enforcement. As for when it takes effect, well, it won't be right away. The next county budget will get hammered out next July, and supervisors say that they'll implement the full effects of Measure J by 2024. All right, you've heard that cases of coronavirus are increasing in L.A. County, and I'm sure after all this time, you still have questions. We have an expert ready to answer all of them. That's next when Take Two continues. Stay with us. Back now to more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and streaming on the KPCC app. I'm Amy Martinez. While our attention has been wrapped up in the presidential election, the number of coronavirus cases in the country and the county has been climbing. Here's Dr. Paul Simon, Chief Science Officer for the Los Angeles County Department of Public Health, talking today about an increase in the positivity rate.
Now we're seeing a very slight gradual increase. We got to a low of about 3.2% positivity, up now somewhere between 3.5 and 4% test positivity.
It is now estimated that one in 670 Los Angeles County residents are infected with coronavirus. Last week, it was more like one in 1,000. Here to help us make sense of the numbers and discuss what it means for our day-to-day lives, we have Dr. Robert Kim Farley, an epidemiologist with the UCLA Fielding School of Public Health. Doctor, can we unpack these case numbers a little bit more in terms of demographics? Who exactly is testing positive?
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be back on with you again. You know, again, we have a situation of the disproportionality of cases and deaths due to COVID-19. Mortality rate, for example, in Latinos is three times higher than that in white and two times higher in African-Americans in white. This is also reflective, really, of areas of poverty in our community. Those with greater living in areas with greater than 30% poverty are four times higher to die than those with less than 10% in poverty. So this is, again, a problem of systemic racism in the past, as well as the issue of, you know, having to work or being in very crowded environments for many of our population.
And doctor, what do we know about how many of these cases are ending up in the hospital or worse?
Yes. So fortunately, the deaths have actually been maintained relatively steadily. And the situation is that probably because a lot of the numbers of people coming down with disease are younger. We've seen this change in demographics. And so the people who are younger are at less risk of hospitalizations, of severe disease, and dying.
So, doctor, what's your best sense of what's driving this latest increase?
Well, I think we have a situation where basically we have a bit of pandemic fatigue sitting in. People are not as conscientiously wearing masks at all times when they're out. We have situations of parties being reported, for example, lots of people without masks close together inside. I think as the weather gets cooling down here too, we're going to look for more of that as people come inside. So I think that we just have a little bit of people letting down the guard, so to speak, and we're just seeing some increasing numbers of cases occurring because of that.
And those numbers that are increasing in California specifically, Doctor, because I watch the NFL on the weekends and I see certain stadiums in certain parts of the country, Texas and Florida, for example, where they're allowing people in the stadiums. Now, it's not anywhere near full capacity, but still, it is people gathering, you know, in a place where they're around other people. And I think California has not allowed that. So fans can't go watch the Rams or the 49ers or the Chargers, yet these numbers are still going up. So I keep wondering now, well, I can't say that those states are completely in the wrong because, I mean, it's going up everywhere.
Yes, I think that's a good point that you raise, A, but the question is the degree to which it is going up. And we see some real spikes occurring in many states outside of California. In one sense, I think we have a success story of California in that we really truly have flattened the curve. We haven't crushed it like you might have seen in China and some other countries. Yeah. So we go back to zero virtually, and then we can almost begin to bring back our normalcy of life. But nor have we yet seen a sharp spike increase like originally, you know, happened in New York, for example. They still have over 33,000 deaths have occurred in New York, which is almost twice as many deaths as we've had in California. So we are smoldering along here. And we're having to kind of dial in or dial back our control measures as we see either increases of cases or decreases.
Talk to Dr. Robert Kim Farley, an epidemiologist with the UCLA Fielding School of Public Health. On the positivity rate when it comes to old versus young, how is that breaking down?
Yes. Yeah, so again, we have a situation that for those that are in a situation like, say, a nursing home where there's been an increase of transmission in a nursing home, then they'll have high rates of positivity in those folks. Right now, our positivity rates are seeking more, though, towards younger people because they are beginning to circulate, going about their lives, are beginning to see some limited school openings and things like this as well.
On the fatigue thing that you mentioned, Doctor, were you kind of expecting that? I mean, we're not doctors. So I think for a lot of people, they think, well, eventually it's going to get better. Then when it doesn't, it just beats you down so much that your guard goes down.
Yes. And I think also, what's happened is that we have such mixed messaging going on throughout the country at different levels of the country included. So that I think that also confuses people, makes some people say, well, gee, it really isn't as bad as others would make it out. And so I think that's created some division, some controversy in the society. And so I think that also contributes to not having everyone, if you will, on the same page as to what we need to be doing to be able to get this totally under control.
I want to ask also about the transmission rate. Where does that stand right now? What does it mean for us in Los Angeles? Why is this important to be aware of?
Yes, the transmission rate, or this R naught, the basic reproductive number has sometimes been talked about, is an important number because basically if it's over one, it means every person is infecting more than one other person. Mm-hmm. And so therefore cases will be increasing. If it's below one, which is what we're striving to achieve, that means one person who is infected will infect less than another person. In other words, it would take many more contacts to have occurred. So I think that what we want to strive to see is monitoring this number and get it below one so that we can see that these numbers start dropping and not increasing.
And we're above one, right, in LA County?
Correct.
Yeah.
Wow. And that's why we're seeing this increase up, from in the 900s now up to, over 1,200 on average.
So frustrating. So it's just really depressing and frustrating to know that we're still fighting this as hard as we are. I've seen a lot of headlines, Doctor, about how we are entering across the country a particularly dangerous time when it comes to the virus. Can you tell us a little bit more about that and what we need to be mindful of?
Well, I think the reason we're thinking it might be more dangerous from a public health point of view is just the fact that there may be opportunities for increased transmission occurring. For example, as the weather cools down, more people indoors, transmission is more likely to occur indoors than out. Schools beginning to open up in parts of California and also especially in other parts of the United States. That gathering together of students, again, is a way of increased transmission occurring, and they can take that back then to their families. I think we've already talked about it, the mask fatigue that's setting in, but also even active mask resistance in some places that have occurred. I think that's another thing we're concerned at from the public health viewpoint. And I think finally, just to mention again, we are going to be entering flu season. Yeah. We're still very low levels of flu at the moment. But, you know, to superimpose influenza on top of COVID is something that could be worrisome, especially for, again, endangering our hospital capacities and surge capacity.
That mask fatigue, that mask resistance, doctor, don't get me started on that. My blood started to boil already, but I'll just leave it at that right there. Now, despite all this, I mean, we are in holiday season time. People are going to gather, family members, small groups of friends. The state did allow for larger gatherings, but what do you want people to consider as they start to make these plans? Because plans are being planned now.
Yeah. And I think your point is larger gatherings, but not large gatherings.
Right. Right.
So that, for example, in Los Angeles, if you're planning to get together with loved ones, really no more than three families together at a time. And really that should be occurring outside in the backyard, masks being worn, less than 2 hours, ideally, of contact. And then, you know, if you're serving food, single service, disposable containers being used, that sort of thing. We want to make sure that we don't have these holidays become sources of transmission. And with them kind of one after the other coming up, we don't want to have the Halloween, you know, amplified by the Thanksgiving that gets further amplified by the Christmas season. So I think that we have to hope that our Halloween treated the community as compared to tricked the community. And we really will probably only know that in another week or so as we go out past that 2 week incubation period for the disease since Halloween night.
You know, when it comes to those rules about gathering during the holidays, you know, I've heard some people kind of tell me that, you know, in conversations that they'd rather just the state say don't gather, because some of the rules they don't quite think make sense. So you mentioned gathering for Thanksgiving, say, outdoors. It could be really cold. So who's going to do that outdoors in the backyard or for just 2 hours? Who has Thanksgiving dinner for only 2 hours, doctor? But I guess that's the kind of the pickle that the state is in, right? You got to try and seem like you want people to have a life, but at the same time save their life.
Yes, I think you're right. I mean, we don't only have public health be, you know, the Grinch that stole Christmas, I think that, you know, we're trying to give the guidance out there that at least allows some people to get together. Again, it's not business as usual. It's not normal life, but to try to give some people some ideas of how they could do this safer than just, again, having a large party indoors, lots of people around, and then suddenly having major spikes occurring here in the county and elsewhere.
Now, another thing about the holidays is travel. A lot of people want to travel to visit family. Some people are really wondering whether to get on a plane. I know people are flying more than in the past few months, but how would you rate, doctor, the safety of plane travel right now? Is it any more risky than, say, just walking around L.A. right now?
Well, I guess it depends on what walking around L.A. means. If you were walking around in a hiking trail a distance from everybody, no, airplanes are more problematic than that. If you mean walking around in the middle of a party with no one wearing masks indoors, planes are a lot safer than that. So I think the thing to realize is that planes, you know, are designed. They have these HEPA filters for very intensive filtration of air. They bring in outside air that they mix in. They have the flow of air such that it's not spreading all over the cabin to other passengers. So they're trying to do their best if they can to design planes and design the filtration system to minimize the problems of transmission on an airplane. But you also have to realize, of course, to get onto that plane, you got to go through the airport, and you got to the waiting rooms and things like this. So that probably is even more problematic than actually being on the plane.
One more thing really quick. I just remembered when we're talking about masks, the LA City Council voted this week to authorize business owners to refuse services to people who do not wear masks when visiting the establishment. Doctor, is this a good step? Because it seems to me that should have happened a long time ago.
Well, I think you're right, Ace. So I think we should have put you in charge of that. So yes, it should have happened a long time ago. We should empower businesses because this is, again, where there could be potential sources of transmission. And if, you know, the patrons know that, you know, they've been tasked to have to do this, maybe they'll be more willing to, you know, listen to the business owners too. So I think that's important. I really think, you know, in a sense, the speed at which we control this pandemic and the speed at which we can, you know, further open our businesses and school and the speed in which we can then, you know, go back to enjoying being in the company of others and our families, all that's going to be determined by the degree to which we really do play our part, and each of us, our role in doing these guidelines of masking and physical distancing.
Nobody wants me in charge, doctor. That's Dr. Robert Kim Farley, epidemiologist with UCLA Fielding School of Public Health. More Take Two coming right up.
A pleasure.
All's my life I has to fight. All's my life I hard times like yeah, bad trips like yeah. Nazareth, I'm f***ed up, homie, you f***ed up. But if God got us, then we gon' be alright.
Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and on the KPCC app. I'm E. Martinez. While California's votes aren't consequential to the presidential race, California's money does have an impact. Like in years past, both parties tapped deep pockets in our state to help finance their campaigns this year. And the LA Times' Maria Torres has been doing some digging into how the owners of LA sports teams spend their money, both in the partisan and the nonpartisan issues they supported. Maria, before we get into specific team owners, you found that as a whole, sports team owners in Los Angeles did not reflect the usual political spending of other owners nationwide.
Yeah, it's definitely it kind of breaks with the trend just nationwide. There were several reports done by other outlets during this election cycle that looked at all sports team owners in the country. And taken as a group nationwide, they typically support more Republicans in their causes. Whereas here in Los Angeles, it's a bit different. As you can see, like, there's definitely more interest in helping out the Democratic causes and campaigns.
And maybe it just lines up with the teams being in California.
Yeah, maybe that could be part of it. I will say, like, the biggest supporters of these causes, some of them outside of the Ballmer family, definitely spent a lot on political spending.
Owner of the Clippers, Steve Ballmer, yeah.
Correct, yes. If you go and look at who spent based in the group out of LAFC, it's a huge ownership group. A couple of the owners in that group actually spent a lot on Democratic causes, and those two people were people who were mostly in the tech industry. That was kind of interesting, too, to point out.
All right, so let's look at the team that just won a championship, the Los Angeles Dodgers baseball team. Actually, a pretty large group of people. Mark Walter is in there, Peter Gruber, Billie Jean King, Stan Kasten. So when it comes to the Dodgers, how do the Dodgers owners spend their political donations? And what does it tell you about what's important to that organization?
Todd Boehly, who's also part owner of the Sparks, he spent mostly on Republican causes, and his donations totaled about $139,000. And then you look at a couple of others who spent heavily in the past. Robert Plummer is one of them. He only spent $5,600 on this donation cycle. There's a couple others who, you know, made donations to the Democratic causes and campaigns as well, but the biggest spenders were on Republican causes.
For the Dodger owners?
Correct. Yes. Came mostly from one person.
Yeah. So, and that's the tough part when it comes to compiling this, right? Because one person could spend a lot, and it almost feels like, Maria, they're speaking for the organization when they might not be.
That's correct. Yes, that's exactly the tricky part. And that's what we wanted to make clear. This report that I did with my coworker, Tiffany Nguyen, we wanted to make clear in the summary of all of it is, like, a lot of these teams are owned by groups of people, and it's not just the one family. So it is kind of hard to, like, just make a judgment based on the one person in the group spending a lot of money.
All right, let's go down the freeway a bit to the Angels. Artie Moreno is the owner of the Angels. So who did he spend money on in the election? What do you make of that one?
Yeah, the one with the Angels is actually kind of interesting. Artie Moreno and his wife Carol spent a lot of money on the Trump campaign during the previous election heading into 2016. And this time around, they didn't put any money into the Trump campaign. They spent on McConnell for Majority Leader Committee, a lot on McConnell, some on Tiffany Shedd, Collins for Senator, and they had matching donations. So in total, they spent roughly $78,000 on purely Republican campaigns. It was interesting to me to note that, you know, Artie Moreno was a panelist on with the Latinos for Trump when Latinos for Trump came to Arizona, and yet he didn't, at least according to FEC data, did not donate to his campaign this time.
All right, moving on to basketball. Jeannie Buss is the controlling owner of the Lakers. Her brother, Jim, has a stake as well. But according to campaign donations, they have very different political affiliations. What do we see in the Lakers data?
Yes. So Jeannie Buss donated about $7,500 overall to Democratic causes. About a little bit more than half of that went to Act Blue, which, is a nonprofit. So they disseminate the money elsewhere. But yeah, she made a $2,700 donation to Kamala Harris, his campaign for president. When it comes to Jim Buss, he donated right on down the line to Republican campaigns and causes. I don't have the exact totals right in front of me, but most of it went to Donald Trump's presidential campaign. Some went to McConnell as well. He made a lot of small donations through WinRed. Mostly everything is geared towards Trump's campaign and to McConnell.
And you know what the interesting, Maria, about the Lakers breakdown is, I used to be the host of pregame and postgame Lakers talk on ESPN Radio back in the day. And I was doing that show when there was the drama between Jeannie and her brother Jim in terms of control of the Lakers. So to know that they are on each side of the political spectrum kind of answers a lot of old questions that I had back then about the relationship.
There you go. So you keep finding out more things just based on some political contributions.
We're talking about the political donations by the owners of LA's sports teams. And we're doing that with Maria Torres, a baseball writer for the LA Times, who's at home with her dogs. Now, you mentioned the Clippers earlier. That's Steve Ballmer and his wife, Connie Ballmer. They were very, very excited and really focused on a few things. And they really spent a lot of money. Where did they spend their money?
Between Steve and Connie Ballmer, they spent roughly $6 million to ratify Prop 25, which would have eliminated cash bail in California. They also each spent $500,000 on support of Prop 16, which would have ended the ban on affirmative action. Connie Ballmer also donated $7 million to Everytown for gun safety. So that's just another campaign to improve gun safety in the United States.
What about our two NFL teams? The owner of the Chargers, I know, is the Spanos family, and the Rams have Stan Kroenke, who is married to Ann Walton Kroenke of the Walmart fortune. So I'm wondering where their money went.
So we couldn't find anything for either Stan or Ann Kroenke in this election cycle. Previously, they have donated to the Trump campaign. They also donated to the Clinton campaign in years past. However, this year, we could not find anything through their names, through, Ann Walton on FEC data. We did see some stuff from Whitney Kroenke, their daughter, but it was also very minimal support, although all of her support was to Democratic causes and campaigns. But yeah, nothing from either Stan or Ann that we could find on FEC data.
All right, finally, one more owner to talk about, and that's Philip Anschutz. He owns the LA Kings, Staples Center, LA Live. And with the Anschutz and he and his wife, Nancy, it seemed like they were probably the most aggressively partisan owner in terms of where they put their money.
That's correct. The Anschutz, Philip and Nancy spent about a little under, I think, $1 million on this election cycle. And all of it was to Republican causes and campaigns. However, they do have also, through the Anschutz Entertainment Group, they donated in state elections and California state elections. And almost all of that was to Democratic causes. And that was roughly $100,000 that they donated.
Maria, considering how the sports world this year was probably more politicized than it's ever been, what do you think we can take away from this report, this project, and the way you set it up? Because it's like one of those things, I think now people really want to know where their money goes once they spend it.
A lot of times, the owners will say something to like almost like look good on camera, almost just to like kind of back up the NBA stances on Black Lives Matter and other racial justice issues and social justice issues. And they're not necessarily putting their money in those pockets to support the causes of their athletes. So I think that's the main thing that we should take away from these things.
Maria Torres is a baseball writer for the LA Times. Maria, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, if you missed any part of Take Two this week, this week has been brilliant, if I do say so myself. Just go wherever you get your podcasts. There we will be waiting to be heard by you. We're also on Twitter @Take Two. I'm there as well @AMartinezLA. That's good for Twitter and Instagram for your social media convenience. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two is back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.